One of the things leaders are paid to do is to see the unseen. We've got to see the future before it exists and describe it with enough clarity and enough detail and enough energy and enough excitement and enough passion that people will actually join us to make that preferred future a reality.
Today, we are in excellent company with an amazing man, a leadership expert, and one of my favorites, Mark Miller. You mention in the book that leaders need somebody to emulate, right? And someone to look up to, a hero, if you will. And you mention that Truett Cathy is one of yours.
Absolutely.
And for those that haven't read the book yet, and let's just say they don't even know the real Truett Cathy behind the scenes. Mm-hmm. Tell me why Truett Cathy is your hero.
Well, let me take even a step back further. There may be folks listening who don't know who Truett Cathy was. Truett Cathy was the founder of Chick-fil-A. He's actually the guy that invented the chicken sandwich.
So he really did invent the chicken sandwich?
He really did. He was the first guy that we know of in recorded history to say, hey, let's fillet this chicken. He actually did that in an attempt to cook it more quickly because he ran a 24-hour short order grill and his customers didn't want to wait because it took too long to cook chicken. So he began to experiment, how do I cook it faster? He took the bone out, found out he could pressure cook it very, very quickly. And then the rumor has it, and I never asked Truett, I wish I'd asked him this question, but I met a gentleman not too long ago. It was after Truett had passed. And he said, you know, I'm really the guy that invented the chicken sandwich. I said, well, tell me that story. He said, well, I was in Truett's restaurant and he had these fillets of chicken. This was in 1960-ish. And he said, hey, Truett, put that on between two pieces of bread and make me a sandwich. So this customer said he's the one that told Truett to put the chicken between two pieces of bread. But we say Truett really invented the chicken sandwich. And my relationship with him goes way back because I worked in one of the local restaurants as a teenager, and it didn't go well. In fact, I think I told this story last time I was with you. I actually quit because I thought it would be better to leave than to have to explain the rest of my life why I got fired at Chick-fil-A, and I felt like my firing was imminent. So I left, and I went and I got another job, and 6 months later, I got laid off. And I thought, shoot, I need a job. And I really am not good in the restaurant, but maybe I could work at the corporate headquarters, which, of course, makes no sense in any universe. I would just say chalk it up to the mind of a child. This was a long, long time ago. So I walked in and I told the receptionist that I wanted a job working in their warehouse. She didn't call security, which I thought was good. I later learned they didn't have security. But nonetheless, she told me to have a seat. And just a few minutes later, Truett came out, took me into his office to conduct the interview. Well, that doesn't make sense. It didn't make sense to me then. I knew he was the CEO and the guy who invented the chicken sandwich. Why is he interviewing this kid to work in the warehouse? Well, I didn't learn that day, but I learned later that he only had 15 employees. And so if you've only got 15 employees, it makes a little more sense for the head man or the head woman to be conducting those kind of interviews.
Sure.
And I tell people it was a combination of God's grace and lack of discernment on Truett's part. He gave me that job working in the warehouse. And that was about 45 years ago. That was a long, long time ago.
Wow.
And so I had the opportunity to work with Truett for many, many years. He's one of my heroes because he actually exemplifies the fundamentals that we talked about in this book. And, you know, I don't know to what extent you want to get into those, but he was a man, he was skillful, and he had a great heart. And those two attributes really comprise all of the fundamentals that we ended up writing about in this book.
So, Mark, would you say he was a naturally born leader? Or did he develop these skills?
Well, I think both. I mean, both, probably. I think he had some instincts that made leading and made him comfortable in the role. But nonetheless, I think he worked at it. He and Jeanette, his wife, used to listen to motivational tapes back in the day. Tapes, your audience doesn't even know what that is.
Right. I know what it is. I told you a little bit.
Yeah. And this was so important to them. They would find good content and they would want to share it with the organization. When new operators back in the 70s, when you became a new Chick-fil-A operator, this is the man or woman that's going to run the restaurant. Part of your welcome packet was a cassette player from Truett with some Charles Stanley and Charles Tremendous Jones audio tapes. Because he wanted to make a deposit in the lives of these new Chick-fil-A leaders from the very beginning. And he and Jeanette would find the content that they wanted to pass on to the organization. And that was 45 years ago. So he was a learner, which is one of the things we talk about. One of those heart habits is you got a hunger for wisdom. And I saw that in Truett for his entire career.
Well, when I was reading your book, I got to tell you, of course, Truett was one of the first leaders I think about when I think of great leadership. And I love, by the way, that you said he grew it. It wasn't just natural. And maybe he had made mistakes early on. And I'm sure you saw some and we've all had them. So, and one of the things you said in your serve, let's go into your book for just a moment. There's five fundamentals to transform your leadership, but let's go into the quick five. But I'm curious, see the future. Can you give me
really quick. One of the things leaders are paid to do is to see the unseen. We've got to see the future before it exists and describe it with enough clarity and enough detail and enough energy and enough excitement and enough passion that people will actually join us to make that preferred future a reality. But it's not just vision. We have to see the unseen when it comes to the strategies we endorse. We've got to see the unseen when we select people or when we promote people because we think they can play at the next level. It's just part of what we're supposed to do as leaders. But as it relates to the fundamental, we would say broadly, it's about when you can weave together those threads of what you know is true today with what must be true in the future into a compelling picture. That's how we're describing see the future.
So because the leader is the one who creates the confidence that we can get there by seeing it so clearly and being able to articulate it in a manner which people believe it. Because if they don't believe it, and I love how you said, give it with clarity and detail. You know, it's interesting. It's good timing that we're doing this interview. I'm working with countless clients, and I've got some clients who their people are struggling with what's the vision? Where are we going? Mm-hmm. And without that, they're just sort of rudderless.
Yes.
Like, what am I supposed to be doing?
Hard to get engagement, sustained levels of engagement, unless you can tell people where you're going. It's like, follow me. It's like, well, tell us where. We're not saying we won't go, but tell us before we go. Tell us before we start. And there are far too many leaders that are either unable or unwilling to paint that picture of the future. Now, let me say one more quick thing. When we talk about clarity and detail, this is a trap that I stepped in years ago, and maybe some of the leaders listening have done this as well. We have got to provide clarity, but we can rarely provide certainty. I actually heard a message by a guy named Andy Stanley, who challenged me on this years ago. And he said, look, people really do want certainty, but don't fall into that trap because there's not much leaders can be certain about. We can provide clarity. And on the certainty front, we can say, here's our intention. We can be certain on that. Here's the time, energy, and effort that we're willing to invest. We can be certain on that. Beyond that, you really, really don't know.
So can I add a little color and ask a question here? Because when I think of, you know, see the future, a C-suite is going to set the future, set the vision.
You hope.
You hope, right? You hope. And I'm remembering clearly when I became a department leader, and then a regional and divisional and executive leader, that at each level, a leader should articulate where they're going, not just the C-suite, but what's my part? What do we need to do? So isn't see the future like create your own, I'm going to call it vision statement, mission statement, by department? Or are you saying just the C-suite? Because when I think of leadership, I don't think they all articulate where their group is going.
Here's the way I would answer that. And I think the last time we talked about culture, if I'm not mistaken.
Yes.
I think leaders at all levels need an appropriate aspiration for their area of responsibility. And so call that vision, call that seeing the future. The trick to your question is they all have to serve the larger vision, the larger mission. Now, that somebody says, well, wait a minute, that's going to create like different cultures. You've got different cultures anyway. We call those micro cultures, and they're not a problem unless you allow them to become countercultures. And a counterculture is when you have a group of people that are working at odds with the larger vision. But you would expect the accounting group and the sales group and the operations group and the warehouse and distribution group, you would expect them to have different cultures. And that's okay. But in service to a larger organizational vision.
So I encourage anybody listening in, depending on what your level is. I remember being a head of training in a company, and I remember going, we're going to be the finest training group in the country, right? That fed into us wanting to be number one in the industry, if you will. And it clearly changed the dynamics of the group because they got a vision for something they hadn't seen, hadn't accomplished. It's like, we're going to win the Super Bowl. Right. Yeah. How are we going to win it? And we're going to be the very best training team anyway. So let's move on. Anyway, I just love, because without that, I think everything else falls away. If you don't have vision as to, and you haven't articulated the clarity and of the unseen, I think the others are struggling. All right. Let's do number two, because I loved number two, by the way.
All right. I'm going to say one more thing about seeing the future. People expect that from their leaders.
100%.
They just expect that. Whether you've been leading for a week or a year or a decade or a lifetime. So I just think anybody who thinks they can get by without having a vision and talking about vision, you're kidding yourself. It is the first among equals, right? These are all important, but without that, you don't even need the other. You don't need
the others. I agree.
All right. So the second fundamental is to engage and develop others. And this is essential and critical. This is when you actually begin the process of rallying people to pursue the vision, right? Mm-hmm. It starts with who you select, and then it continues to how do you create an environment in which those people willingly invest themselves fully? How do you help them care? How do you help them care about their work, their coworkers, the customers, and the organization while growing them along the way? I mean, there's a lot of work here. Leaders, we're going to spend the majority of our time. I've never actually been able to do this, but if you said, okay, how does a leader spend their career? Like, how do they allocate their time? If you look at these fundamentals, my guess is you're going to spend a lot of time in this engage and develop others space. At least the best leaders do.
Well, the best leaders have the best teams. How do they get the best teams? They pour into them, engage them, and help develop them. All right, let's do number three, because I have so many questions.
Okay, number three is reinvent continuously. Leaders understand that progress is always preceded by change. I meet too many leaders that think change is a burden. It's an obstacle. It's an inconvenience. It's a nuisance. It's like those men and women don't understand their role. Like we're supposed to create and sustain positive change.
Yes.
In service of the vision. That is the essence of our job. And so progress is always preceded by change.
I could not agree more, because innovation is one of our core values at Zenix. And I keep thinking, why did I make it a core value? To make sure people know that we are always going to change. And you have to be okay with that. But change means growth. Unfortunately, people think change means uncertainty. And I like change meaning growth.
It can have some uncertainty associated with it.
Well, for sure, because you're helping. Well, what about, isn't change management one of the hardest things in most companies?
Well, it's one of the things that leaders do the worst job of. We just finished, I say finished, we're actually not completed yet. We spent about $4 million so far researching organizational change, trying to help leaders improve their batting average, the numbers have been hard to come by, and we did a global study ourselves, and the numbers are still elusive, but we can't find any data that says more than a third of change efforts are successful. Think
I've
about
heard
that.
I've heard 75% fail. So
right. So it's the other way to say it. Right. Right. So like we're trying to figure out how to help leaders improve their batting average. What if you took that to 50 or 60% were successful versus 25 or 30%? And so we are working on that, and maybe we'll come back on your show when we finish that work. But it is essential. Leaders are not really good at it. And it's probably early for me to declare a reason, but I'll give one quick shot at it because you called it out. Leaders tend to think that change is a linear process. Now, with all due respect to John Cotter, I know John Cotter, respect him completely and totally, but the work he did in the 80s that said there's an 8-step process, if it worked in the 80s, it's not working today.
I agree.
Change is the nature of change has changed, and it is a nonlinear process. Mm. And so that's one of the findings that we're exploring right now. So what is the leader's reaction when trying to lead change in a nonlinear process? And we think it's doable, and we've talked to a lot of leaders who do, but the conventional wisdom is step one, step two, step three, step four, and that kind of change, it just doesn't work.
I got to tell
so
you,
we're working on it.
Think about the amount of investments that are made by executives all over this country who want to implement change. And we just said change is necessary. Mm-hmm. And if they knew, which I don't believe they all understand and know, that 75% of all leader change initiatives fail, which means the investments, the change, the process engineering is going to fail. And I believe very wholeheartedly, I can't wait to hear about your study, because I definitely have an opinion that, listen, people don't change naturally, right? We gravitate back to normalcy and routine. And so if you don't get the people to embrace the change, you don't have a chance. Anyway, we'll right. go. Okay, what's number four?
Number four is to value results and relationships. And here's what I'll say about that. This is, from my experience, we've been talking about this content around the world for about 25 years. And my informal research is that this will be the hardest of the five fundamentals for about 95% of the leaders on the planet. There are about 5% that this is not a particular challenge. And I always say I don't like those leaders because for the rest of us, it's hard. And here's why it's hard. Most of us have a natural bias. We either have a default toward results or we have a default toward relationships. And that's fine. But the best leaders learn to value both. And that'll just require intentional, purposeful effort. And it is doable, but you've got to work at it.
It's interesting to me that you put them together. Like you need to value results and relationships.
Yes. Yes.
Because I'm sitting there thinking about leaders right now who tell me, I love my people who are underperforming.
Right.
And they're going through a difficult time. They haven't produced in 6 months, let's call it. And they love them. They value that relationship. But you've put in the same sentence results. What if you're not getting results and you value someone?
Well, therein lies the tension. Jim Collins wrote about this years ago, not value results and relationships, but he talked about wildly successful organizations. One of the attributes he discovered is what he called the genius of the and. It's when you can take two things that from time to time are in conflict and embrace them both that you unleash tremendous power. There's power in that tension. And so I think the leaders who over-index on either one, results or relationship, undermine results. If you want to maximize results, you need to value both. Clearly, if you over-index on results, you're undermining results. But I mean, if you over-index on relationships, you're undermining results. But you can go the other way, and you can focus exclusively on results, and you'll undermine results.
You'll undermine
the genius of the ant. No, but you'll undermine results. No, I said that correctly. If you focus on results exclusively, you will undermine results. That's not the strategy to maximize results.
Because ultimately the relationships are not engaged to continue with the result.
Right.
But so you lose.
It's both. It's when you do both that you win. And it's hard, but it's powerful. It's powerful.
Powerful. Number five.
Number five is to embody a leader's heart. Embody a leader's heart.
That's my favorite one.
Well, thank you. Here's the deal. If your heart's not right, no one cares about your skills. And I think I can prove this to your listeners. They know someone, a leader, with the skills, and they choose not to follow them. Well, why would you not why would you not follow a leader who has the skills? Because you don't trust their heart. But it's not all about heart, because we probably all know somebody with a great heart that couldn't lead themselves out of a room. Well, you don't want to follow them either. I mean, think about your doctor or your lawyer or your accountant. Do you want her to have skills? Yes. Do you want her to have a good heart? Sure you do. Sure, you want both. And people want and need both from their leaders.
So this is sort of, you know, most people don't talk about the heart when they think of leaders.
Mm-hmm.
And so when I saw that, embody a leader's heart, and I read that, and I love, and I'm going to go to the book for a piece because I'm hoping everybody picks up the book. If you read any leadership book, first of all, it's easy to read. Appreciate the simplicity. Works perfectly.
Thank you. That's all I can do.
Man, I just love it. But I loved early on, you talked about the difference between common greatness and uncommon and the differentiator between the two. And I thought that was brilliant, because on common greatness, you're focused on the achiever. That's being me, if I'm the leader.
Right, right.
But uncommon is you focus on others.
Right.
And I just went, how true is that? And by the way, I've grown as a leader, because it used to be all about me. And I'll be the first to put that out there. And people that have worked for me for 15 years go, oh, the old Casey wasn't so great, but this one is better. And I'm always still evolving. But when I think about the heart, and I think about the story you told about Truett on the path where I think Eddie was going for a job. Would you share that story? Because that talks about the heart, and it almost encompasses number five, number four. I was like, actually, I think almost all of them.
Well, sure. So this was decades ago, before Chick-fil-A existed. Truett had a restaurant, which is still in operations today, in Hateful, Georgia, called the Dwarf House. And it was his original restaurant that he opened with his brother in 1946, and somewhere along the way, Eddie White worked for Truett, and Eddie wanted to go to college. Nobody in his family had ever gone to college, so this would have been in the late 50s, early 60s, and so they put a pickle jar on the counter with a handwritten sign that said Eddie's College Fund, and the customers could just put money in there for Eddie to go to college. And it came time for Eddie to pay his tuition, and he got the jar down and took out all the money and counted it up, and he didn't have enough money to register for that first semester. And Truett said, don't worry about it. I'll take care of it for you. So, by the way, I'm assuming today Chick-fil-A, I don't know the most recent number, but probably have given north of $300 million in college scholarships. Eddie got the first one. And Truett also called downtown and said, hey, I'm going to send a young man down there for you, and I want you to get him some clothes. He's going off to college. And so Truett went to Eddie and said, I need you to go downtown for me and meet with this man. He's got something for you. And Eddie was African-American, and he had never been to this particular store, much less to the men's clothing department. And so he walked in quite reluctantly, and he found the man that Truett wanted him to talk to. And he said, Mr. Cathy wants you to get some clothes for school. And he said, well, sir, I appreciate that, but I don't need any clothes for school. And he said, well, Mr. Cathy's going to be real disappointed if you don't get some clothes, because that's what he told me to do. And he said, okay, I'll take a shirt. He said, no, Mr. Cathy wants you to have a suit. He wants you to have shirts. He wants you to have proper undergarments. Mr. Cathy wants you to be ready to go to school. And so Eddie reluctantly allowed Truett to buy those clothes and pay for him to go off to college. And Eddie went on to become a superintendent in the Atlanta school system. They even named a school after Eddie, but he got his start working for Truett, and Truett helped him start his career.
What a role model when you think about what he did back then that probably embodies why Chick-fil-A has been so successful. He poured himself into others. He had a heart for others. Mm-hmm. So let's end with the question that, you know, we're in some tough, tumultuous times, uncertainties in the market, and we as leaders sometimes have to have a persona that everything's okay. And so one of my questions is, for those leaders that are trying to fake it till they make it, et cetera, and or are struggling, how do you discover levels of joy, and how do you find that fulfillment in their work every day?
Well, there's a lot in that question. So this is probably a great time for my standard disclaimer. I ask you and the listeners to not confuse the brevity of my response with the magnitude of that question. Mm-hmm. So that is a real question. I don't want to honor the question, but that's a big question. So first of all, I think leaders convey a spirit of optimism because that's a reflection of their heart.
Mm.
I think if you're just faking it to make it, I don't think people buy that anyway. But if you're optimistic because you believe in your agency and the power of those around you, your optimism is well-founded. Now, I also think you got to be grounded in reality. The best leaders are always grounded in reality. You can't confront reality unless you're willing to admit what reality is. And so I don't encourage leaders to blow smoke because I think people see through that. That's my first thought. How do you find joy and fulfillment in hard times? Well, first, I'd say hard times are real, and I don't think we need to deny that. Again, that's back to being grounded in reality, because if things are hard and you pretend they're not, your people are going to think you're either out of touch or you're clueless or you lack integrity or worse, right? Mm-hmm. They'll lose confidence in a leader that lies to them.
Mm-hmm.
So I think you got to be really, really, really careful. I think the way you find joy is doing the work you're called to do and serving the people you're called to serve. And that means in the good times and the bad times. So I just think you got to be real careful.
Mm.
You got to be real careful. Optimism that is founded in your personal belief set, I think always plays well.
So I love, I translate that to transparent leadership, to being real where you are, but doing it in a manner where you can see the future. That's why I keep thinking your number one was my favorite, well, number one in five. Well, actually, they were all my favorite.
You liked a couple of them. Yeah, that's
good. I like them all. I'm like, engage and develop your people. Yes. But when I think about doing the work, and I so appreciate in the good times and bad, do you often find that true leadership rises when the markets are hard? When you're in a challenging time, is that the definition of when you really are a leader?
I think you lead every day.
Right.
I think you lead every day.
But
here's what I think happens. I think people notice leadership more.
Oh, love that.
They see it more because you step up and you say, we're going to do this. We're not going to do that. We're going to make it. And here's why. We got to make some tough decisions. And here's why. I think leadership is more prominent in hard times. But if you don't lead in the good times, you won't have the moral authority to lead in the bad times.
How true is that? Listen, anybody listening in, it's five fundamentals to transform your leadership. He barely touched the surface. He gave you some context, but you give great stories throughout what it means, what it looks like. And I would tell any leader, I don't care what level you are, I would read this book. I highly recommend it. And I just got to give you a huge congratulations. I know you've written countless books. I've read them. I love the simplicity of this. And as you just said, don't underestimate the complexity of putting things in practice. However, you got to know the simplicity first of what you're trying to accomplish. So I just need to say thank you for giving me this privileged time with you. I'd love to have you back and we can go through all these other questions I have.
Okay.
But I want to wish you well on the book. How's it going so far?
It's out. And it's excited. It's out.
Okay. Well, we'll put a link here so that everybody can get a copy of it and order it. What else would you like to add?
Well, just give them my cell number. Okay. 678-612-8441. And if you prefer, you can email me, mark@leadeveryday.com. I'd love to hear from you and serve you if I can.
So, again, everybody pick up the book, Uncommon Greatness by Mark Miller. What a privilege. Thank you so much, Casey. Mark, for your time today.
My pleasure.